Good morning, everyone. Thank you, Jules, for giving me this opportunity. And great talks, Chris and AJ. We'll see how my talk goes. But I want to mention that I'm really glad I'm here today. And literally, I'm really glad I'm here today. After driving for 2 hours and pouring rain from West Lafayette to Indianapolis, and the flight getting delayed by a couple of hours, and not just that, right before takeoff, finding out that my hotel reservation is canceled. But I'm here. I'm very glad I'm here today. Thank you for giving me this opportunity. When Jules asked me to do this talk on greenhouses, the issues I have is I'm not a historian. I'm not an ethnobotanist as well. So I just wanted to do what I am good at. So I'm basically a crop physiologist with some, I'm basically an environmental physiologist. So I decided that let's tie the historical aspects with environmental monitoring. And I put slides together today, keeping that in mind. So please keep that in mind. And most of my slides are coming from web. So thanks for all those people who posted on the web. I did read two books, both of them given by Jules. He wanted to make sure that I read those two books. Thank you very much for those. And that was good learning too. So what we're going to do today, some of the initial slides, probably the previous presenters have shared already, so I'm going to briefly touch on those slides. But then I want to talk about how this whole greenhouse, modern greenhouses have evolved, mainly focusing on the environmental management, environmental control, in terms of the greenhouse structures, in terms of heating, evaporator cooling, and also artificial lighting. So where are the roots for all those? I mean, we have there's a picture here from Gotham Greens in Chicago, a highly modern greenhouse with hydroponic facilities. These systems, they are movable NFT systems with subliminal lighting and temperature control. So this is where we are today. So how did we get here? And that's what I'm going to focus on, okay? So, disclaimer again, Jules, I learned good thing. These are not cucumbers. They are cucumis mellow. So if you copy and paste from web, watch out for that. But again, I want to mention that again, giving emphasis to this emperor, Roman emperor Tiberius for starting this. One thing I like, Jules of Tiberius, he decided to grow locally. He didn't want to import from Hispania or whatever that is, but he decided to grow locally in his own palace. So that's great. He wanted to eat him every day. So that's nice. So we have to give credit to this person. And I have a few more slides later on about the mica piece you talked about. I think lapis specularis, and I will give you a little bit of information about that particular mineral. It was most sought out mineral in those times from in Roman times. But we'll get there. So we're going to give credit to this person. He's the one who started this. And cucumbers were stored during wintry days in those houses called specularia, specularibus. So here is the picture of this great emperor. Chris talked a lot about orangeries. French call them as the first greenhouses orangeries. And in fact, the same picture was shared by Chris. And then when the pineapples became popular, they started calling us pineries. So orangeries and pineries. And the one that we have here, the one that at least George Washington built, is probably close to a pinery because he was interested in growing pineapples at his place. But I want to talk a little bit about English glass houses. The first interest actually came from wealthy, and it probably has to do with the glass tax. I do not know why they impose tax on it. Maybe they just want to keep those structures with wealthy. It's just a showcasing of how wealthy they are. But this is a picture publication by Mr. Vallon, 2012. And you can see people actually climbing Himalayas. So here are some expeditions. So these are people from England. They are going around and trying to find these exotic plants all over the world. So that's how they started. So the interest was to collect these exotic plants, and when you're bringing them from all over the world, you need a place to grow them in a controlled setup. And so that's how probably this whole glasshouse controlling environment aspect started. So Chris talked about this glass tax, about 100 years, and what actually basically happened is that they started taxing, and because the glass was sold on weight, basically what it did to England was most of this glass industry moved away to Ireland, and because the tax act was not there at the time in Ireland, and also to other parts of the Europe like Netherlands. For 100 years, only wealthy people could afford. If you have a window, you have to pay tax. So if you read this lettering carefully there, and this is actually, I guess, a receipt from a tax collector, and it says certain amount is being taxed and is paying on this particular day, 1755, but for laying duty on houses, windows, and lights. So there was tax on all those things. But then, I think as I go through and read through the evolution of glass houses, the biggest thing that happened was removing this tax act in 1845. The glass tax act in 1845, that allowed a lot more inventions. Glass houses became more common, and the technology became very viable. And there are a couple of greenhouses that came very early, and glass houses came very early in England. They are the Royal Horticultural Society and the Royal Botanic Society, both in the middle part of 19th century. And here is a picture of that. I want to talk a little bit about the United States. I know Chris mentioned a little bit about this. So what happened here? Andrew Faneuil, a well-to-do Boston merchant, is the first builder, the first American greenhouse in 1737, historically. George Washington actually had a glass house. It's probably more like a pinery, but he was interested in growing pineapples for his guests, so he built one for himself. The one house in Maryland that still exists is the White House, is the oldest surviving greenhouse in the United States, and that's the picture of that. And there's been a lot of research happening in the last 5 to 10 years, and what they're finding is actually those people who worked there for many, many years, they were not just simply working there. They were actually collecting a lot of data on medicinal and food plants. So they are excavating that the floor, and they are finding all this information there. Okay, so that's just the setting the stage for the historical aspects of greenhouse. I want to focus on three major structures that are very common globally. But then before that, so here is something I found on the web. So this looks like a multi-span greenhouse, and this is from 1800s, and they were actually able to do some nice designs. What really attracted me is this piece right down here. Right there is a gutter there, right? So to collect the moisture. But then they have actually created a design which collects moisture not only from top of the roof, but also the condensation inside the roof, and it slides down. Where is my mouse? Slides down this part, down right into this, and gets collected. So there have been a lot of designing work going on way early as 1800s. So this is actually a nice picture. I was surprised by the designs. I can't read more than that because I'm not an engineer, but I was able to find that interesting piece. So let's talk about the Dutch greenhouses, because these are the greenhouses that really revolutionized vegetable production, the Venlo style greenhouse. Most of you probably know this term, Venlo style. So where is this Venlo? So it's in the southeastern part of Netherlands, and if you're from Netherlands, please chime in if I'm saying anything wrong. But what I learned was it's right on the border of Germany. This is one of the areas that got hit bad during World War II. And the history says that there were some agents, British agents, who were spying on Germany, and they were trying to somehow get to Hitler. But then those agents were found in Venlo. And at the time, World War II, Netherlands was neutral. But this Venlo incident, what they claim, is the one that dragged Germany into war with the Netherlands. Pretty much, Venlo took a lot of hits from German attacks. A lot got destroyed. But the nice thing is the place rapidly rebuilt very quickly after 1950s. And now it is a center for large greenhouse marketing. There are many companies that Venlo-style greenhouse that they sell, they come from this. So here is a Venlo greenhouse. The nice thing about this Venlo greenhouse is they're tall. You get a lot of light penetration to the greenhouse. It's very good for vegetable production. Generally, we prefer tall greenhouses for vegetables and then much wider ones for floriculture crops. But then that's the origin of this Venlo greenhouse. The other thing is the greenhouses in Spain, and I think we need to give some recognition here. And if you look at this picture down here, it's taken from space, and maybe some of you have seen this. These are all greenhouses in Almeria region of Spain, and that's the this is slightly different structure. I'll talk a little bit about that, but I wanted to talk about this picture. 100,000 acres under roof. There's the largest collection of greenhouses in the world, one place. I'm not sure about this information, but what they are claiming actually is that those greenhouses reflect a lot of sunlight because of that white roofing, and they're actually cooling down the temperature by a couple of degrees in that area because of that. Large area. But 35, 40 years before, this area was a dry, semi-arid region. Nothing there. There was not much water. Hydroponic culture using soilless substrates and modern technology is what made that region look like what it is today. So produce tons of vegetables to entire Europe in these greenhouses. These are unlike the Venlo style. They're low. They have poly. It's a double poly, but then it's a low-cost greenhouse, and that's why they're actually able to put that much area under roof. The main problem is temperature control. A lot of heat inside. It's very hard to work in these. People from all over Africa and Middle East, they actually come there to work in these greenhouses. And if you talk to some of these workers, they will tell you how hard it is inside to work. But because of cheap labor, cheap investments, and very good environment, a lot of light, they can actually produce tons and tons of vegetables in this greenhouse. So that's another major type of greenhouse. If you look at globally, Venlo style and Parral or Almeria style. The third one, Asia kind of talked about, is the solar greenhouses from China. I will mention a few things here. Like Ajay mentioned, there is the north wall, and also on the sides also there are walls, right? And then we'll get back to the heating. When we talk about heating, I'll mention a little bit about what's happening there passively. But then the roof is south-facing, so there's plenty of sunlight. And they also have a blanket at the top, so they cover that at night. If you know the science behind heat loss from greenhouses is through the long wave radiation, right? So they're trying to close the greenhouses and keep the heat at night. So these is another. So these three are the major types of greenhouses where, like you already seen the video, acres and acres of high tunnels. Similarly, they also claim that in China. The solar greenhouses, you have huge area under the solar greenhouse. So it's Chinese solar greenhouses, the Parral type in Spain, and the Venlo style mostly in Europe and in the United States. So the three major popular greenhouse structures. And that's the background. That this is where they've come from, and that's how they've been with us today. Okay, so after the structures, let's move to the greenhouse heating. The earliest information that we can find on the web and also from the books, literature, are these Andal or the floor heating from Korea. So there is I do not remember the name of this book, Jules. It's something like starts with Sangarika or something. It's a cookbook basically written in Korean language. And they mention this type of cultivation. If you look at here, it's basically a fire stove right here. And they have created some structures to ensure that there's not too much wind coming through. But what happens is the smoke is, the heated smoke flumes are going through these pipes down here, and then they heat the floor, and they grow inside these Andal-type systems. So 1480s, quite way before we started seeing this passive heating in Europe. Fruit walls of Montreal, am I pronouncing it right? Montreal. Thank you for helping. In France, another form of passive heating, and I think this is mainly for grapes, and so they used to grow grapes along these walls. The heat is absorbed by masonry walls during the day and released at night, but also I think more production is coming from the cold winds at nighttime, and that's another form of passive heating. I want you to really appreciate that how the technology is evolving with time, and not just from the start, from the previous talks, also all the way from the orangeries to the to where we are. So keep that in mind as you see these pictures. And then you mentioned about the stove, Dutch stove, the forcing houses. Again, heating in the floor and then bringing the heat up, and the southern sides let the light through. So these, again, another form of pass, forced heating. But then that the interesting thing that I really found on the web was this chart. So data collection was there. Controlled environment, agriculture, really, you need to be monitoring your environment. So this is key. And I found this, and I'm going to spend probably maybe a few minutes here looking at this data. They are showing for the month of August, and there are different days at the top. I don't know why it is 30, but there's probably one more day. But then degrees Fahrenheit on this scale, and there are different structures here shown the temperatures during different days in August. I think this is open air outside, and what I really want to point to is the pinery or the orangery, the number of degrees gain in heat because of the closed structure. The hard beds even harder than that. So I guess this has to go to Gabriel Fahrenheit, who invented the thermometer. I think they had thermometers those times, so they probably were just simply hanging a thermometer and measuring the numbers in probably one corner, so it's probably not as accurate. But the nice thing I wanted to really point to here is the interest in monitoring the environment, collecting the data, and keeping those records. And there are a couple of publications that came out during the time, and if you are working in greenhouse or control environment, you will quickly see how nice these papers are. 1788, this guy, Thomas Tregault, 1788-1829, he wrote a paper on the relations of heat, moisture, and evaporation in natural and artificial atmospheres. So they were kind of already comparing things and looking at these variables. Another one here, horticulture differs from agriculture by creating artificial climates affected by an enclosed atmosphere in an artificial structure. This was a talk given by John Daniel. And so there's already interest in data collection, publishing this data. So that's growing already by early 1800s. So here is another heating technique, the one that Ajay showed, passive heating. Heat grain from sun during the day, released back into the greenhouse at night, and the blanket is used as a thermal insulation. This is a solar greenhouse from China. I also want to talk a little bit about geothermal heating, because we do see a lot of interest in the United States using this technology. The whole technology has been there since early 1900s, but only became popular in 70s. And I think it has to do with increase in gas prices and trying to figure out some alternative methods to heat greenhouses. The credit goes to two countries, Hungary and Netherlands. Those are the two major investors in this technology because of their natural benefit. They actually have large greenhouse area under geothermal heating. We are exploring in Midwest, but we have challenges, and we have to be real good engineers at designing the structure. Otherwise, we may not go beyond 50 degrees Fahrenheit, even with the geothermal heating. But this is gaining importance in Midwest as an alternate form of heating, especially with growing heating costs. So far I discussed about different methods of heating and how they have evolved from 1400s, the Andal Korean type greenhouses, to passive heating, the Chinese solar greenhouses, and also to geothermal heating. Let's look at how the technology evolved for cooling. So obviously we are looking at countries that are hot, because that's where cooling is needed, and the data points to Egypt. The first documentary evidence for cooling actually comes from Egypt. There is some information out there that shows that the slaves used to hold water in earthen pots, and they used to fan these pots to blow cool air. And I'll talk about that in a minute, but so royals used to sit in the middle of the room, and they used to blow air so they can get cool air. And also, this has evidence that shows that wet sheets, cloths were hung along the airways, so as the air is moving into the room, it's cooler. Here's a picture from Indus Valley civilization. It dates back to the Egyptian civilization, but you can see these earthen parts. And I'll tell you this, seeing myself in person, even today, if you go to rural India, especially in summer, earthen parts are used, and the water is like actually 10 degrees cooler inside. Simple technique, as water evaporates, it cools. So this technology is there for a very long time. But the thing that really interested me is this picture down here. This is from ancient ruins from Kuwait. Again, hot places. So you got to look for hot places. And what they did was this particular Failaka tower, it enhanced the cooling power. So you have air blowing through. That's just ventilation. How do you cool that? You have to blow it through water, right? And that's what we do with evaporative cooling pads in greenhouses. So they actually did that. So they used to have water in the underground areas, and they channeled the air through these underground areas, and this air was moving through the water. It was cooling off, and then they used to send this back air to the living rooms, the Venturi effect or whatever you call it. When you reduce the volume, the speed increases. So that's how they used to send cool air. Pretty identical to the evaporating cooling technology that we use. And I'm now talking like 1400, 1500 AD. So that technology was there way before. But I think we have to give credit to this person, Willis Carrier. You probably know Carrier cooling systems. He's the one who invented psychrometric chart. So why are we interested in psychrometric chart? Well, again, evaporator cooling. How many of you are familiar with the wet bulb, dry bulb temperatures, right? So basically, the dry bulb temperature is the ambient air temperature, right? So how much heat is there in air. But the wet bulb temperature tells you the minimum temperature you can get by using evaporator cooling, right? Remember those psychrometers from those days and sling type psychrometers. So as you do that, what happens? Evaporative cooling happens, and it tells you, well, it's not theoretically the actual temperature. There are some losses in the system, like up to 5 to 10%. But then this chart tells you there are at least the several variables here. You can look at the dry bulb temperature on one side, then you have a wet bulb temperature going this way, and then the relative humidity. So he was able to figure out that both the relative humidity and temperature are crucial to determine the evaporative cooling capacity. So I think we should give credit to this person as early as 1904. And that's exactly what we're using in our evaporating cooling techniques today. So how did this evaporative cooling actually become commercial in the United States? Again, we have to go to hot places like California or Arizona. The whole, what we call swamp coolers, basically, they're air conditioners, like, you know, boxes with water filled in pumps, and then you recirculate. Very common in many developing world, even today. The Aspen Pad swamp coolers were demonstrated for the first time in Phoenix in 1916. And till 1950s in the United States, most of the cooling is through ventilation. But then around that time, we started using actually evaporating cooling technologies. It's about 1950s. Look at this company. They actually are advertising their swamp coolers. I think it's Gotel Brothers from Arizona. But I was interested in reading that advertisement. How do you invite people to come to Phoenix, the air-cooled city in the Valley of Sun? So a lot of sunlight, and it's also we can cool hotels. So it's 1950s, and when we started this technology of cooling greenhouses. After that, we still use the evaporative cooling predominantly here. All right, something that's near and dear to me from some heating and the cooling, let's move on to lighting, artificial lighting, and see how that whole technology evolved over time. So Jules Brod introduced this concept of using this particular mica, a selenite, or it's basically, you can also call it lapis specularis. It's a mineral, it's a sheet. Just to cover the he showed you this nice video of the hearts going in and out. Remember that? That's lapis, the specularibus. And I wanted to focus on that material, lapis specularis. So that's It's like gypsum, mica, it's a selenite, and if you Google out lapis picuera, there's a ton of information about it. This material was available in Spain, and Hispania basically, and it was one of the precious minerals that people were sought after. And I think the reason for that was it was, I think, before glass, it was the glass of those times. It is translucent, not like glass, totally transparent, it's translucent. So it does allow some light to go through, but it also provides some protection from cold weather. Here's a picture. They used to cover it with lapis picuera at the top, and then they had this fumes at the bottom. But I Googled out and found that this is the actual mineral, and you can see that the transparent nature of that. So it's a it's diaphanous, technically speaking, both light and it's very light too. So that's another advantage. So you can nicely place on the roofs, and it also allows some light to go through. If you look at modifying spectral composition, we're all after, you know, including me, research on modifying spectral composition and look at plants. I think if you look at the history, the first documentary evidence of modifying spectral composition goes back to 1840s. So they were, remember I showed you a picture for the glass houses, people are all about exotic plants. They were bringing plants to London. And then these are tropical plants, and you know tropical plants require less amount of light intensity. You can't grow them in really high light. So they have to somehow tweak with the transmission of the glass. And so what they did was they actually did some experiments at the Palm House in Kew, and came up with this copper-tinted glass. And here's a picture. This is a more modern one. This is how that copper-tinted glass looked. But the evidence shows that they actually used this material as the roofing material to lower the intensity and modify the spectrum. So 1840s, they were looking at light intensities and light levels for plants, and how do you modify that? The other thing I also want to bring up is these structures. If you've been to St. Louis, the Botanical Gardens, you'll see these huge geodesic domes. They were built for a reason. If you look at the structures, those triangles, they create such a, you know, you talked about 50 mile per hour straight winds. I think this is the type of structure, maybe made with frames and steel. Those triangles give it structural strength. And that was the main reason why they, but in addition to that, if you look at the dome, the shape follows the solar path, so the light that you get inside is maximized because of that. And that really helps in winter to keep that heat. And so these are big technology, but they're expensive. Maybe technology one day will take us there. There are a lot of, online, there's a lot of information about how you can make this with less money nowadays. But that's another nice invention in terms of lighting. But then the real thing, and I use this word, electro-horticulture. These are nothing but artificial lighting. But that was the term that I found that they were using, electro-horticulture. And the first artificial lights are carbon arc lamps, invented by Sir Humphrey Davy in the 19th century. And I just pulled some research information that used carbon arc lamps in actually horticulture research. And here is a picture. So basically, if you have some carbonaceous material and then you send electricity to that, put 4-inch gap in between and light is created there. And this is a commercial carbon arc lamp. You can see here people have done research using that. The thing that really interests me is this person, Simons, observed that when he put these lamps 3 feet above the plants were injured, the leaves were injured, there was too much light. And so then he moved them 7 feet, and then he was actually able to grow plants, high-quality plants. L.H. Bailey, 1891, found that carbon arc lamps actually hasten maturity. So all the things that we know, that we add light, you grow plants faster, growth rate goes up, so you can have nice quality and early maturing crop. All that stuff was done way early in 1850s and 1890s. Carbon arc lamp was the first lamp. After that, incandescent lamps. So who invented incandescent lamps? Anybody? Edison, if we can say. So there are a lot of people are associated with the invention, but I think it can be given to Edison for the robustness of the lamp that he built and the pressures that it could hold. Here is the first Mazda lamps that GE started in 1909, and they were more expensive than the carbon arc lamps, but then they lasted longer. Nowadays we compare LEDs with HPS, isn't it? They're more expensive, but they last longer, just like that. The Mazda lamps were so popular, and here's some of the pictures. They became popular choice in greenhouses. The catch was that the light contained a lot of far-red and near-infrared light, so a lot of heat and a lot of stretching used to happen inside greenhouses at those times. Then came the sodium vapor lamps. 1920s, first invented by Arthur Compton. Again, Compton. Okay, and here's the picture of him. And here is the first one of those sodium vapor lamps. It's basically, there is some sodium in there, and you heat it, and then it vaporizes and releases light. First commercial low-pressure sodium vapor lamps. So there's a low pressure, and what we are using is now high-pressure sodium vapor lamps. And it took some time to get to that high pressure. But the first ones were actually commercial by Philips in 1932. But it took to discover that chemical Leucolux as again. A scientist in GE discovered that, but he's not credited with the discovery. These are the three scientists who are credited with the discovery of the HPS lamp, Loudon, Schmidt, and Harmony, and they invented in 1964 using that chemical. And so what that chemical really did was it was actually able to hold more pressures inside, and that's the reason why they were actually able to create this much more energy efficient, lasts much, much more longer than the low-pressure sodium vapor lamps. So I would like you to see, look at that evolution from the carbon arc to now sodium vapor. And then here we are with light-emitting diodes, right? And this is the current technology. And this is going to be my last slide, and I just want to spend a few minutes here. The key discovery that happened was in 1907, the discovery of electroluminance by Henry Round. So basically, it's a semiconductor. These LEDs are semiconductors, right? And there are electron holes. Electron holes are nothing but regions where you don't have electrons. And what happens is when you send some electricity to the semiconductors, the electrons are converted to photons. And that's electroluminescence. That's what we're seeing. That's light. And that discovery was made in 1907 by Henry Round. The first LEDs were built in Russia by Oleg Lesov, but they were not really bright. Just a little bit of light coming through is not really popular. But I think in 1955, the discovery of the gallium arsenide by Ruben Bronstein, that you can get infrared emission, was the key, because that led to the discovery of the first LEDs, the infrared LEDs, by James Baird and Gary Pittman in 1961. So the infrared ones are the first, and then came the red LEDs. That was in 1962, so not too long. Nick Holonek discovered red LEDs. But then afterwards, the main blue LED was missing. So you have red, and then there were some greens and yellows were also done by Nick Holonek's students. But the blue was missing. And it really took until 1960s by the Japanese scientists to really figure out. The three scientists who were awarded Nobel Prize in 2014, Nakamura, Akasaki, and Amano. And I'll talk about Dr. Akasaki and Dr. Amano. So Dr. Amano was a postdoc of Dr. Kasi, and they actually did a lot of preliminary work on building the blue LEDs, but then that technology was actually taken from that level to commercial level by Shuji Nakamura. The picture of him is showing there with the blue LED, and he received a lot of awards, but all three of them got the Nobel Prize. And he still works with the Nichia Corporation in Japan, but then he is credited with that blue light LED. And with that, now we have the blues and the reds and all other colors, so you can create white light, but that's not how white light is created, like all of you know. It's mostly due to phosphor enhancement effect, right? That's another chemical that kind of revolutionized. It's not economical to use green LEDs to create white light, but that phosphor was there. So that's my last slide, and hopefully I try to do something. Like I said, I'm not a historian nor an ethnobotanist. All I did was what I know a little bit. So I appreciate you all coming, and thank you very much.